Hey, welcome to Offworld, an entirely new show where we are exploring all things space exploration and pop culture. I am Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. We're both from Tested.com. And some of you may find this series familiar if you've watched the video portion of it on our YouTube channel or on the website. But as some of you have requested, we are going to put all these episodes out also in the podcast format.
Yeah, we're starting the podcast right now, and we are starting with our very first episode of Offworld Contact, the 1997 film about, well, you know, alien contact and what that might be like based on the book from Carl Sagan. And it was, I don't know, it's just a classic, classic film.
It totally is classic. And also the making of this film being 20 years ago was really important, I think, in the science community, which was, I was so surprised that you knew one of the people who was involved in the making of this film, our guest.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Jill Tarter from the SETI Institute. She was the basis of Carl Sagan's book on the character that was played by Jodie Foster, Ellie Arroway. And, you know, having her and getting to talk to her about what it was like to be involved in the filming of Contact and also what it's like to be literally searching for alien life in our universe is pretty incredible. It's a pretty incredible discussion that we've got lined up here.
Really excited for you to listen to that. But if you are new to this show, one of the things that we want to point out is that while we'll be talking about the intersections of pop culture, whether it's books or films or TV shows and space exploration, we're not here to necessarily pick the films apart. We do want to dive into the scientific aspects and what they may have gotten right, but you know, we also understand that they're writing some fiction.
Yeah, we're fans here, you know, and it's all about, you know, getting into all of the weird and funny and whimsical aspects of films and, you know, talking to our friends, both from science and science fiction about, you know, what is interesting about these things and how it relates to real life.
So without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Jill Tarter.
Today, we're talking about Contact, the 1997 film based on astronomer Carl Sagan's book of the same name about the search and subsequent discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by astronomer Dr. Jill Tarter, who is the holder of the Bernard M. Oliver Chair for SETI at the SETI Institute. She's also a trailblazer in SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the co-founder of the SETI Institute, and the past president of the California Academy of Sciences. She's also the subject of a new book, Making Contact, which is a biography of her life and all of the struggles and successes that she's had. Thanks for joining us, Jill.
Oh, Ariel, it's really fun to be here. Norm,
yeah,
nice
absolutely.
To be here with you.
And for the film Contact, you were involved with the film.
I did get involved. It was a lot of fun. I had some long conversations with Jodie Foster about scientists in general, personalities, and she was very clear that she wasn't going to teach any science to anyone with this movie, but she wanted to portray scientists as real people. You know, passionate, stubborn, you know, hung up, and I think she did a great job.
So the Jodie Foster character, Ellie Arroway, was partially inspired by you for the book that Carl Sagan made and then the subsequent movie?
Yeah, well, Carl wrote a book about a woman who does what I do, right? And so up until a signal is found, the experiences are ones that I'm very familiar with. And I really enjoyed the book and the movie as well. And the thing that I'm sad about is that Robert Zemeckis, the director, actually changed the ending of the movie in order to facilitate a sequel. But we've never had a sequel, and it's 20 years on.
A sequel would be, like, incredibly awesome, but I'd also be curious what that would be like. So this movie was really inspirational for a lot of people. I've even heard from people who got into astronomy because of the movie
right.
Contact. What were some of your favorite parts of the movie? What did you love about it?
Well, I loved the scenes at Arecibo because that's such a very special telescope. The VLA, the Very Large Array, not so much. We haven't spent much time doing SETI there, but we certainly spent a lot of time at Arecibo, and it's scenically gorgeous. And I do like the fact that you never see the alien, right? So it's left to our imagination what they are actually like. And you see a personification of a human instead of an alien. And I think that's a really good touch because I don't think we're smart enough or inventive enough to actually come up with alien life forms that might actually be out there.
Yeah. What about you, Norm? Like, was this kind of influential to you as a geek, or like, how did it impact you?
Totally. The visualization of discovery. I mean, all the sequences, yes, it's heightened for Hollywood, but the sense of urgency, it's like what every science fiction fan dreams of, mm-hmm. I feel like, and it's something you live day to day. You felt like that was pretty accurate.
They did a really good job. Make me a liar, right? That's the... Tell me everything that I have to explain in order for us to decide that this is really what we think it is.
Yeah, for me, the thing that I loved so much about the movie when I saw it, so I must have been, I guess, a preteen around the time it came out, I loved what you were talking about, the alien part, the fact that sort of they enter her memories and you know, she's at her memory of Pensacola Beach, and she's on the beach and she sees her dad. And a lot of people have been like critical of that scene. But for me, like growing up, I was like, whoa, what if, you know, aliens are just photons, or what if they're able to really just enter our minds and that's really the only way we're ever going to be able to interact with them? I think it was really influential to me, is showing me that aliens don't have to necessarily be, you know, little green men.
Or even the curly trees, right?
Right. No, it's that particular scene of meeting your father is so Carl, because Carl Sagan lost his dad, and he had a fabulous relationship with his father, and he would have given anything to have one more conversation with his father. But Carl is nothing if not an atheist, and this is a dissonance for him. And so he was working that out in the book and in the movie.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about like the opposite side of this movie, of like, what are some of the cringeworthy moments, things where you just like, it still 20 years later, you're like, oh, I can't get over this fact.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a huge innumeracy in the film, right? So Jodie Foster is with Matthew McConaughey up overlooking the Arecibo superstructure. And she goes, look, up there, 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And if only one in a million of those had planets, and if only one in a million of those planets had life, and if only one in a million of those aliens were transmitting, there would be millions of signals. Now, she's taken 10 to the 11, multiplied by 10 to the minus 18, come up with 10 to the 6. I mean, that's 13 orders of magnitude wrong. It just is. Apparently, Carl caught this error in the script a couple of times, and they didn't fix it. And this scene precedes the first kiss, so the romantic anchor of the movie. And so when Andruyan came to the Jet Propulsion Lab shortly after Carl's death, and we had a memorial celebration for him, she wanted to show a piece of the film, but it was so long, and it was still being cut. So Warner Brothers gave her this piece because they knew they weren't going to lose that anchor. But you have a group of engineers and scientists in the room who go, when they watch that, right? And we tried to get it fixed.
They did the math. You guys did the math, and it didn't work out.
Oh, yeah. It's really discouraging that we teach our young people how to deal with numbers, orders of magnitude, so poorly that I think most of the audience never got that. But it really hurts me every time I see it.
For me, the thing is when they're doing that intro shot, which got so much acclaim, because I think at the time it was like the longest continuous computer-generated
yes.
shot at the time for a movie in 1997. And it's this beautiful shot, and they take satellite imagery from the Earth, and they're sort of pulling back from the Earth, and then they start going into the CG of the planets, and you know, you're hearing the radio waves as you go back through time. And I was watching it the other day, and I think it's like at Jupiter you were hearing JFK got shot,
right?
But you're only 45 minutes light time away from
right. It only takes you 6 hours to get out of the solar system, right?
Yeah, so not exactly like JFK. So that part is like, I love like the intro shot because it's so beautiful, but the concept at least comes across. But yeah, at Jupiter, you're not quite at the as far away from
right.
Earth as JFK.
But I thought, you know, overall, I thought they did a really good job, and I guess the other scene that makes me kind of cringe is when she's sitting on the hood of the car with the earphones and the signal starts to come in. She pulls in all her electronics and jumps in the car and starts transmitting on a walkie-talkie in the middle of a giant radio telescope array. The frequency that walkie-talkie works at is a low frequency, but it would have mixed into the intermediate frequencies of the radio telescope. You would never do that during observing. If you take a cell phone, right, a 1-watt transmitter in a cell phone, and you put it on the moon, that's the second strongest radio source on the sky. So you would totally have drowned out your signals.
So let's talk a little bit more about that scene. So it's the scene where, Jodie Foster's on the hood of her car. She's in New Mexico at the very large array. She is listening, and it's mostly quiet. She's listening to, like, one radio transmission, and then she begins to hear something, a pattern in the signal. How realistic is that from the get-go? You know, are you able to ever tune into just one transmission? Did you ever have headphones on listening to radio transmissions when you were searching for extraterrestrials?
Well, I didn't, but it is possible to shift the radio frequencies down into the range at which your ear can work. And we did have a blind physicist working with us, Kent Cullors, who was not in the book, but did get written into the movie.
As Kent.
That's Kent. Yeah, that's Kent. And we would, in fact, sometimes downshift the frequencies so that he could listen to it.
So it's filtered for human ears.
Yeah, we just have to get the frequencies down low enough and the frequency range to be something that the ear can handle. And, you know, it's not very realistic because when you think, as good as our brains are, right, and our hearing's pretty good, but it can't possibly deal with all of the signals, the hundreds of millions of frequency channels that we use with our back-end processors to look at or listen to what we're observing.
So in this case, she got incredibly lucky because not only did she hear a pattern, but she chose the correct frequency and the correct signal of hundreds of millions of them.
Well, the whole frequency had been compressed, so... Yes, but the brain can't do 100 million things at once, I don't think.
Right. So what was it like, you know, you got to actually work on set of this film, and were they really science curious? How much did they study, you know, your personality, and what was it like generally for you being
well,
there?
Well, they adored Carl, and he went on set when they were in the East Coast quite frequently. He would give them lectures on astronomy, and they just... really, really were very fond of him, and they liked the storyline they were dealing with. And I loved all the technology having to do with making a movie. I mean, they had some really good gear. And so I was thinking, you know, if I didn't like what I'm doing so much, making movies would be kind of a cool thing to do.
Yeah, so this movie came out, you know, 20 years ago. What's sort of the current state of SETI? You know, has it evolved much from what they depicted in the film? Is SETI today any different, or is it mostly the same?
Well, SETI today is different, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So quantitatively, our computers are so much faster that the amount of data that we can process is just vastly larger. So we can do the same searching, but much faster. But we're still looking for artifacts. With the new thing that we're doing that we weren't doing 20 years ago is we're working in the optical as well. So in the radio part of the spectrum, we look for frequency compression. We look for very narrow band signals and only on one channel on the radio dial. Nature can't do that. But in the optical part of the spectrum, we look for time compression. We look for bright flashes that last a nanosecond or so. Again, nature can't do that. So we're looking for these artifacts that we could confidently say, if we found them, those are engineered signals.
So
we're doing more of that than we've ever done before, but we're actually qualitatively changing what we do now. We're beginning to finally have the technology to have some sensitivity to transient signals, signals that don't stay around for a long time. So in the optical, we're doing all sky, all the time, optical. And in the radio, we're just trying to figure that out. So that's a goal. And the other thing that we're doing qualitatively different now is we're beginning to go away from just those simple artifacts. And we're trying to figure out how to use machine learning to have the system tell us what signals are there, rather than having us tell the system what to look for. And that's a whole new approach for us.
So what would the process of discovery or contact look like today? Would it be an email, a blip on a screen?
Well, it's still going to be the computer that finds the signal. And at the SETI Institute, with the Allen Telescope Array, we do our signal processing in near real time. So when there is a signal there that we haven't seen before from some other direction on the sky, we immediately follow up on it. We observe in three different directions at one time, so that a signal that is coming in the peripheral vision of the telescope, its side lobes, would show up in more than one beam simultaneously, and we can say, no, that's not coming from that star. And then we do a series of off observations and back on, and a whole logical tree to figure out whether this signal is really something we should be interested in, or just noise. But there's the persistence required. The signal has to stay around at this point for minutes before we've done enough playing around and cross-checking that we really think we're interested. And then, yeah, lots of text messages and emails and, yeah, that sort of thing.
So perhaps the updated movie version would be like looking for laser pointers in the sky or...
Exactly, blinking lights. Right, or something like Starshot, Yuri Milner's project to use a very, very powerful laser to accelerate a tiny little stamp-sized spacecraft to Proxima B, the Alpha Centauri system. And that laser is so strong that for a short time, if it passed across us as it was accelerating a spacecraft on a distant planet, we would see it. And it would be really unmistakable, but transient.
That's one thing that I love, actually, that I was really thinking about with watching this movie over again. It was the fact that so often we depict when we receive signals from alien civilizations that they're always intentional messages. You know, in this case, it was primes and, you know, but if we detect a signal, it could be just watching someone's propulsion system for their little spacecraft to get across the solar system, and the light could maybe not have any meaning to it. It's just a system that another civilization is using. I think that's kind of cool.
It could be, or it could be dual purpose, right? We have multi-use technologies here. It could be an accelerating laser. It could also have information embedded on it at the same time. So the reason that we talk about deliberate signals is because they're going to be by far easier to find. Somebody has put gain into the system. Somebody's transmitting powerfully in order to gain our attention. For all the other leakage signals, the television broadcast, radio broadcast, airport radars, etc., there's only enough power being transmitted to do the job, illuminate the next town over, not the next star. So leakage signals are, by and large, for the kinds of technology that we understand to date, going to be relatively weak compared to something that someone could generate deliberately.
Yeah. So one thing also that struck me about the movie is I felt like they did a very good job of portraying the challenges that the main character faces and the struggles of being taken seriously. So again, now that we're 20 years after this movie, do you still have those struggles in being taken seriously? Do you think there's been a shift in perception where you don't have to prove that this is a worthwhile pursuit anymore? Or are you very much facing the same sort of challenges?
Well, for SETI, it's better. When we started out, our main challenge was to distinguish ourselves from ufology and other pseudoscience. I think we've worked on that hard enough. We've published enough in the scientific literature. We've shown that this is a scientific exploration, that that's not so much a problem anymore. It's still there, and people sometimes take a lot of pleasure in deliberately confounding those topics. But I think, by and large, given particularly all the exoplanets that we now know about, and the extremophile, different types of life that can live in environments when I was a student, I was told, absolutely no way, that's going to be sterile. Well, it isn't. And those two game changers, I think, have made SETI somewhat more believable, immediate, and respectable. So I think the next thing is the technosignatures.
I think the movie did a really good job also showing some of the consequences, you know, within the scope of a two-hour film, with the cultural ramifications, some of the fanaticism becomes a big plot point. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about what type of cultural resonance any type of discovery or any type of contact might have?
Yes, we do. And we've held any number of workshops over the decades about the cultural significance or social implications of the detection of a signal. And you know, end of the day, we really can't say much. We bring in these experts, and the best they can do is that the world will react to the announcement of a signal in terms of whatever belief systems are around at the moment. And you go, yeah, we played your plane fare for that, right? We really can't say, other than communication is so instantaneous and so continuous that I think that diminishes the potential for any fearful reactions. And by the way, a lot of the world's population already, unfortunately, thinks that we've been visited. It's not going to be any news to them. I wish that they would be a little more critical in their assessment of what kind of evidence they have for that visitation. But I think we spend a lot of time talking to people because we want people to think about this. It really could happen. And we also want to use SETI as a way to change the world's point of view. We would like SETI to really reinforce to people everywhere that we're all Earthlings. We are all the same when compared to something else that might be out there. And with this more cosmic perspective, go about all the other challenges that we have that we find so difficult today, that don't reflect and don't respect national boundaries, but we have to work on. And if people just can use SETI to see them in a see themselves in a much larger framework, I think we can make progress on those other challenges.
See, it's pale blue dot. It's introspective.
Exactly.
As well.
It's, you know, searching for aliens and finding ourselves.
Yeah. So my final question, I guess, is, whenever we discover extraterrestrial intelligence and verify it, how will that change your everyday? How will that change for you?
Well, I think the movie got it absolutely right when Jodie Foster first heard those pulses. She goes, holy shit, right? that's about the level of expression. We will immediately start looking for number three. Having found number two, we know that there are going to be many, many other technological civilizations out there, and we'll start to go looking for them so that we can do not just comparative planetology, but comparative sociology, right? How different are they from one another and from us, and what can we learn about who they are and what they understand of the universe? And most importantly, as Jodie Foster did say, it's how they've managed to survive, to become an old, stable technology, because we can see many ways that that might not work for us. We might be very short-lived, but if we detect a signal, that's the really positive message. We can't succeed in SETI if technologies, on average, don't have long lifetimes, because there'll never be another technological civilization close enough to, for us to have the sensitivity to detect it. And lined up in the 10 billion year history of our galaxy, unless technologies are long-lived, and then we can hope to overlap. So success in SETI means that we, in fact, can have a long future.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find out more about your work and SETI and potentially even get involved in some way?
Right. the website, SETI.org, is a place where we have a lot of information. There's a site called SETIQuest.info, which allows you to follow the observations that we're doing at the Allen Telescope Array every day and see the signals that we're seeing and seeing what the system decides to do about them. Like, that's interference because I saw it 2 weeks ago from another direction on the sky, that sort of thing. But SETI.org is a good place to start. And then Berkeley SETI program also has an extensive website, and people can get involved in many ways.
Awesome. Well, thanks again so much for joining us today. This was an awesome conversation and gave me a lot to think about.
Well,
thanks.
It's a pleasure. And I always like talking about contact. And I really feel great when someone comes up to me and says, I got involved in science because of that movie.
Absolutely. So it was incredible to talk with Dr. Jill Tarter about both contact in the context of 1997, but also now 20 years later, and how technologies have changed, and really just about where contact sits in a cultural context with a lot of people, both in and outside of the space industry.
And for someone who had a character basically embody her wish fulfillment, the thing that she'd been building toward and has been building toward her entire career, to hear her say that oh shit moment would be how she would react, I think that was super cool.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to ask Dr. Jill Tarter about if she would want to go herself, but I think she would want to go, and I think I definitely would want to go, even though I get motion sickness very easily.
Totally. And I think the film, of course, still holds up. If you haven't seen it, we highly recommend it. And this is just the first of many films and tropes that we'll be talking about on the show. You can listen to the other episodes. And if you have feedback, if you have thoughts on the film, you can always reach out to us. We're on social media. Ariel, you're at?
I'm Ariel Waldman on Twitter, on YouTube, on nearly everywhere.
And I'm at N Chan. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.